This is the Fantastic Books Podcast,
the fantasy and sci-fi book review podcast for fantasy fanatics, book nerds, and lovers of lore and stories.
Covering some of the most loved fantasy series as well as brand new novels.
With your hosts, Anna
and Sam. Let's see what we're reading this week. Welcome back, fantastic listeners. This is Sam.
And Anna.
And again, we're joined by author Nathan Ogloff, covering The Sapient Empire, chapters 19 through 22. Nate, great to have you with us. We are in our penultimate episode. I can't believe we're closing in on our grand journey with your first novel here.
Yeah, that's been great. I've been having so much fun being here, and I'm glad to have been along for the ride, guys. Thank you so much.
Oh, yeah. Our pleasure.
I mean, I feel like we're along on the ride because you wrote the book, so.
I like seeing how people react to it, so that's what I meant by the ride.
Gotcha. So. Yeah, we are, like Sam said, at the penultimate episode. We're definitely gearing up for this conflict with the Rust Raisers, which is starting in this section of chapters, but I think obviously the grand finale will be next week when we get to the end of the book. And things have just really been snowballing, I think, for the Domain and the Rust Raisers. Like, the conflict is on the up and up. The amount of development that is happening in the Domain in this section is just growing and growing, which has sort of been a trend for the past couple of chapters. But yeah, there's a lot to talk about.
Yeah, the world is definitely exponentially expanding, and it's interesting to see how our characters are doing as far as trying to maintain a sense of control over their world.
Yeah, I think one theme we're seeing that popped up a lot in these two chapters is like things can't go back to the way they were. And then also growing too big too fast has consequences. So
yes,
those are kind of the big undercurrents happening in this set of chapters. But I think we have to kind of talk about everything to get to the heart of those.
Yes. So without a further ado, Chapter 19. We begin this chapter with the date of April 11th, CR, and we have our characters Kellen and Celia and his crew are back at the original off-grid, and it's being rebuilt.
Yeah, so this was their idea last time to tackle the population problem and some of the materials and resources problem was to go back to the off-grids and take advantage, especially of the scrap metal that is at a lot of them. So we see that they're rebuilding, Celia in particular is rebuilding the greenhouses, they're rebuilding defenses. And then Kellen goes and talks to his nephew Mattis to touch base with what's happening with this mining. So they're essentially mining a midden, which is a trash pile. And Kellen and Mattis had some conflict about, like, just kind of character conflict in general about moving back and forth and what was going on in the world. But it seems like at this point they're getting over it. But unfortunately, by the end of the chapters, the conflict between the two of them crops up again. And they are, like I said, mining old garbage dumps. So they're full of old machines and old machinery. They're pulling the metal out. And I've actually heard of this as being an idea for our own world, mining our landfills and garbage dumps. Is this something, Nate, that you think is like a possibility in our own world someday?
This is actually where I got the idea. And so I thought, because I like taking sort of just aspects of our own culture and just sort of making them archaeological, again, the way we look at, say, old, like a campfire, a place where hunter-gatherers used to have campfires, and like you see bones and like charcoal everywhere, or you know, again, the Roman ruins, maybe even some buildings from the Middle Ages. But I like taking this idea of taking a trash dump and then saying, oh, there's use here. A lot of the organic matter would have dissolved, but the metal is still going to be very relevant. And so I think it's also something that's happening today. I've heard of it. I've also heard of using trash dumps as a source of power, in a sense, because they've got a lot of decomposing like natural gases that happen. And so it's possible to harness a lot of that. But it's those two aspects that I really got this idea from and said, hey, it'd be kind of cool if like I said they're going to salvage the past to form their civilization of the future.
I think that's super realistic. I think, again, like I've heard of this idea of mining garbage dumps, so I think it's something we're going to have to do at some point in our own future. I'm sure they're full of really important resources, especially like precious metals, you know, in parts of like computers and things that have been thrown away. But even ancient civilizations do that thing where they'll like repurpose stone blocks. And sometimes archaeologists will find like, you know, if you flip a stone block around, it had a, you know, it's been turned around in a building now because it had a facade on it from when it was used in a building from a civilization that was ancient to them. So people are pretty resourceful. And I like that you've been really incorporating that in your world where resources are pretty scarce.
Oh, definitely. And as we continue with this chapter, Kellen talks to Shindo at the Midden because he is manning a mining machine. And Kellen warns him that there are old machines in this dump. And so, you know, there's dangers and resources afoot, so to speak.
Yeah, one thing that's kind of cool that was just a little bit of world building you mentioned is that the Rustrazers get these machines tattooed on their bodies as a sign, and I quote, of the day the world was made for them. So they really worship more this idea of machinery and kind of brutality, whereas the domain has their religion centered around the abstract. And I like how that's really played out in the two opposing cultures here.
Yeah. Kellen and Mattis debrief, and Mattis is sure that Shindo is a bit odd, but he has good intentions. And he even goes on to say that, quote, he generally wants to help us, but he's not a leader like you're a leader. You try to calm people, persuade them, and even charm them from time to time, but he doesn't do that. I guess he thinks actions speak louder than words, so he doesn't bother with the words. And that was a great way to describe Shindo's character from the outside. It was a nice vignette, as it were.
I think it's good. It really shows that he's a leader by example, not a leader just through speaking.
Mm.
Which, again, like plays so well off of Jerem, who's like the sort of organizer and the figurehead. And then Shindo's really the one down on the ground, like meeting with people and influencing them in their day-to-day lives by doing the work alongside them. And I think those are both different types of leadership, and we're seeing again how they can work together really well.
Yes.
One thing that in this conversation between Kellen and Mattis, though, is that they mentioned that Shindo is still wearing the crown, and we're starting to see more and more implications of Shindo having little episodes with the crown. So I'm getting a little nervous about this as the end of the book is coming. So I'm worried that there might be a critical moment where Shindo really needs to rely on it, or where he needs to be present, and then maybe the crown has backfires on him or something. So
yeah.
I don't know. It seems too good to be true because it's given him so many ideas, but I'm worried.
Everything has a price.
Yeah, and it's definitely coming.
Yes, exactly.
So while they're there and they're having this side conversation, Shindo actually receives a message from Jerem saying that the Rustrazers want to negotiate, which we know that they want to negotiate but have the plan fail, as per our chapter with Engine last time. So we know what's happening. There's a sense of dramatic irony here where the characters don't know what's going on. And Shindo's smart, though. He uses Kellen's information and experiences with the Rustrazers to try to get a better sense of what's going on. And Kellen is very straightforward. He tells him that the Rustrazers will not negotiate, expect the unexpected. They will do anything and everything to get ahead. So he is not hiding any details from Shindo, and I think it gives them an honest impression of how the Rustrazers are, but I'm not sure how well they take it into this negotiation.
Yeah, so Jerem and Shindo are waiting at the central compound, and five Rustrazers have come to, quote, negotiate.
Seems ominous.
Yes. There's a character, Torque, who's there on behalf of Engine. Torque offers to leave the off-gridders alone in exchange for resuming trade for the domain and to leave their territory. And Jerem says that they won't leave the territory. So things are getting complicated.
Yep. So then he comes back with a counteroffer and says that, like, all right, well, the domain can stay in our territory. You can go back and rebuild these bases, stay where you are, but you can only trade with Engine's crew. And then Torque kind of waffles on whether or not they're going to leave the off-gridders alone. So he definitely has something up his sleeve. And as soon as Jerem offers this final deal, which is, okay, trade with the domain, and then you keep the other gang crews away from the off-gridders in exchange for a bonus. But she doesn't say what the bonus is, so I'm not sure what she was planning here.
Yeah, it could either be financial compensation or maybe resources. We're not too sure.
I thought she was lying.
Well, yeah. I mean, when you keep it vague,
I don't know. I don't think they're going to get the bonus anyway, because everything goes to shit really fast. So they agree on this, and then immediately Torque is like, well, cool, you didn't say we couldn't go wherever we want, so we'll pull right up to your doorstep. So this negotiation, again, it works for the Restraiser's end goal, which is to have the deal fail, but it's not what the Domain wants at all. Jerem's immediately irritated, and she tries to take them all prisoner in an attempt to entice Engine out. So she captures Torque and his four other Restraisers. I'm not sure if Jerem thought this was going to be a good idea or if she just didn't know what else to do here, because it seems a little brash, and I'm surprised Shindo let her take prisoners, because he's usually pretty altruistic.
Yeah, definitely was a moment of, we're poking the bear. Like, you sure about that? Is that a good idea? Like,
I don't think it is, as we see the heavy retaliation for this.
Yes.
So after the prisoners are taken, Jerem is still in the base, and she is questioned by her commander, Caden. And one other theme that I forgot to mention that we see coming up towards the end of the book is that people are starting to question Jerem's experience.
Mm.
I think it's interesting to start to sow these seeds of doubt right before the final conflict with Shindo and his weakness with the crown. And then Jerem, we're starting to remember, like, hey, she has a lot of good ideas and all this knowledge from the archive, but she doesn't have a lot of actual military experience. So even though the Domain has been successful, we've been watching them be successful for 10 years, coming up on this fight, this conflict with the Restraisers, you're reminding us, like, hey, this is kind of new territory for them, and I don't know how it's going to go.
Yeah, I found that very interesting, because although Jerem is a good warrior singularly and been an effective leader, it's creating this sense of dread and anxiety for the reader, where we're like, oh, you know, there is a possibility of failure. This threat is very real. Do we have the planning and resources available to overcome this obstacle? So, you know, it's hard. We don't really know how many Restraisers there are, how many are available to fully throw themselves into this conflict, because they have the type of demeanor where they'll do whatever it takes, which makes such a potent enemy that much more threatening. So they really, they got their hands full.
The stakes are getting higher and higher as we're coming in towards that climax of the book. So I think I was a little more confident last time that the Domain would be totally successful in this, but I think it's going to be a tougher fight than we thought. And speaking of which, so he's questioning Jerem's experience, wondering where she came from, because, you know, before 10 years ago, no one had ever heard of her. And he also asks for more men to protect the bases. They're building up the defenses and building up the mining efforts and everything. So we're seeing that they've kind of stretched themselves thin as well. There's not enough people to go around.
Yeah.
So Jerem tells him that she came from a sulfur mining town. She gives him a little bit of background on herself, but she's pretty guarded still. She doesn't really reveal that she doesn't have the experience that he's asking about. It's pretty interesting. So in this case, she is pretty quiet about the conflict that she has with Caden. But she has some other experiences later in these chapters where people question her authority as well. And I guess when you're writing her, how do you decide how she's going to react to these challenges?
So basically, the whole premise is that she's keeping a secret. And when people start walking up to the, you know, start knocking on the door of those secrets, she has to come up with an answer quickly. And sometimes she has a pre-set answer that she's like, I'll just throw this out there. But there's always the possibility that somebody asks something that she can't immediately rectify, because you can't just tell people like, oh, that shrine, I actually came from there and it's an archive and blah, 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 blah. Because in the first part, I mentioned that people don't always react the way you think they're going to react to that. It's when I write her, it's that combined with she knows she doesn't have all the answers and that she doesn't have a lot of experience with this. But because in the previous part of the book where if you challenge the Arch Lord Chief and you win, you're allowed to be there. And according to the divine right of the abstract, it was like, well, that was just destined to happen. Hence, you have it. But The whole tangent I'm trying to go on here is that I think somebody who's not narcissistic or sociopathic or have an ego, they are going to have internal doubts about, am I making the right decision? Is this the right thing to do? I sometimes don't feel like I know what I'm doing. And so I wanted to capture that without her explicitly telling anybody else but Shindo himself.
No, I think it works well because I think there's a, I'm not sure exactly which chapter it was in, but I think there's like a part where someone challenges her and I think she just says like, well, that's why I'm the Lord Chief and you're not. And
yeah.
Like, I think they caught her off guard a little bit. And so she has to really just double down on her authority in that moment of like, don't question me. Whereas here she gets a moment to have a little bit more one-on-one. So she's definitely navigating a tough situation and I'm worried that her secret is going to come out.
Mm.
So more challenges for them to face with the last little bit of the book. Oh, Sam, you had just like a side question.
Yeah, this definitely was more of a sidebar moment, but at one point in the conversation, it's mentioned that the Rust Raisers once fought with the ghost tanks, which we had learned about way earlier within the plot. And I didn't realize that they are described with invisible flames. I would love some elaboration on this as far as like hypothetical technologies involved.
This whole, the ghost flame tank is actually based off of, again, another sort of experimental flame tank they were going to deal test in World War II. But the reason I call it a ghost flame is because a methane fire actually burns in the ultraviolet range. So it's a very hot fire, but you can't see it. And so that's what it is. So basically, if you don't understand that, I'm just emitting like a methane fire everywhere and stuff's just going up in flames, but you can't see the flames and you're like, what the fuck's going on? It's going to be a very harrowing psychological experience. And so that's just one of the inventions Shindo made and my explanation for how the ghost flame tanks are made.
That's really cool. And I like that there's like science behind it too. I think I had thought that maybe they were like the tanks themselves were invisible, but I love that the flames are invisible because that's, again, psychologically terrifying if you can't see the fire.
Wow. All right. Very cool.
I'm glad you asked.
I know.
Speaking of ghost tanks and Rust Raisers, the Rust Raisers come and attack the base a little bit later in the evening. So Jerem's like settling down for the night and there's this big explosion and everyone's running around. Obviously, they're coming to try to recapture back the people that Jerem took prisoner. And she's actually really smart here. So I think she does have at least a grasp on military strategy because there's a bunch of explosions happening at their front gate. These are these guys like kind of self-exploding themselves and they're throwing grenades and like making this big explosion. And she's like, I bet this is a distraction, which is super smart. So she actually runs around the back of the compound and people have gotten in back there and they're a lot closer to getting the prisoners out. So she's sending soldiers around. She specifically wants them to keep Torque alive and keep him as a prisoner, specifically so she can use him as bargaining. But in this fight, a Rust Raiser pulls a pin out of a grenade and then somebody shoots him so he falls and the grenade explodes right there, which was right next to all of the prisoners, including Torque. So for a minute, we think he's dead and that all of this was for nothing, but they dig through all the bodies and at the bottom, they find Torque and he is still partially alive. So little saving grace for them. At least they still have their main prisoner. But when they assess the damage the next day, the Restorators definitely made a dent in it, but they still have pretty functioning defenses. Two towers and a crane were damaged, but I think that they can still work with that. But the real concern here is that they can't figure out how anyone got into the rear wall. They look for evidence of climbing, they look for boot prints, and they see a bunch of footprints, but it's not clear if they're from the Rust Raisers or not. And the best guess that Jerem has is that like maybe they climbed and they didn't leave any ropes or anything because they're not really worried about dying, as we have seen from the Rust Raisers. There's no real conclusion to this, so it's a little bit ominous that the Rust Raisers were able to get in, and I think that's something in their defenses for the end that they're going to need to be really concerned about.
Yeah, it definitely adds to their mystique. Again, that looming threat feeling of them having unknown abilities.
Mm.
And so with this in mind, especially this particular attack, did you look up or research real military fighting tactics to put into your book? Was this something that you just consider would be strategically a good assault?
I didn't do too much military research just because it's something you can do until you're just blue in the face. And I think they understand it. You have to be just have that kind of background. And plus I find that I can do research, but then I kind of come up with like my own strategy anyway. Like a lot of this is just, I think of every possibility and then I kind of break it down into probabilities and then I explore all of them in the story. And then it's just a assessment, advantage, disadvantage. What's like going to screw us over the least? What, there's something else. Oh, okay. So like as an example, with Jerem's fight scene, in the earlier parts of the book, mm-hmm. I did do some research on martial arts, but then like I kept settling on this fact that what if she just has an acrobatic way of fighting, which is, loosely based off of a martial art from India called Kalari Payattu. And so I was like, oh, this is pretty interesting. I'll just make her do this. But again, I didn't study specific moves because I just would end up coming up with my own thing regardless. And plus, I'm not writing a technical manual. I'm telling a story, but I'm just trying to give you enough evidence and knowledge that like, oh, these people have skill in this and they do apply it in these situations.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense, especially because like the fun part about writing a fantasy or a fiction story, is that you don't have to waste time doing all that research. You know, you can just say, here's what I know of the world. Here's what I've seen from other places or cultures or histories and kind of just take inspiration from that and make your completely own creation. And I think that that ends up being a lot more entertaining than, you know, like a manual or a history book anyway.
Yeah, for sure.
Because I've definitely read some of those like sci-fi books where you get really deep in the weeds of like the science or like the machinery of the spaceship and you're like,
cool.
Okay. Yeah. Cool. Like, I'm glad you learned all this for your book, but I don't know if this is really compelling story for me. Mm. So yeah, kind of just giving us enough to get into the story and say, oh yeah, the Restorators definitely know what they're doing, and I still have questions about how they got in there, so a little concerning. And it, again, just building up the tension for the end of the book. Jerem tries to torture Torque in exchange for how the Restorators got in, so I am a little concerned about her development as a leader, too, because she's kind of stooping to some tactics that I don't think she would originally have done. The torture here is pretty brutal. Especially because at first she tries dunking him in the river. They'd set up like a crane to hold him underwater, but he doesn't break. And so she shifts her tactics to hitting him in the base of the spine with a hot metal poker, which is really intense.
Spinal tap.
Seems more like something Vibran would do than Jerem would do. So we're starting to see her push her boundaries a bit as a leader. But we are revealed through this that Engine is at a shrine. I'm not sure if he said a shrine to the abstract or a shrine of Rustrazer or shrine, but I'm worried that he's found an archive.
Mm.
If there's other there's other archives, right? Jerem wasn't at the only one.
You gotta read the next book in the series.
All right. Fair.
Like, so there's the shrine in that we've mentioned previously, but then the Rustrazers have just little areas here and there that are like remnants of, say, like a mine or like a place that used to be a factory and the buildings have all collapsed and then they just call them shrines. So it's not the same shrine.
Okay. Yeah, because I think that they've clearly got more of like a machine-based religion with the way they tattoo the machines on themselves and everything.
So they would gravitate towards sites where there's machinery and technology.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. Okay, so he's at a shrine, and Torque agrees to take her there. And that's sort of like the end of that chapter. Jerem's a little disgusted with herself, but she's happy with her results, which plays a little bit into our concerns as readers of, like, how far will she go? Which remains to be seen. We will need to see how far she'll go to, like, save the domain in this fight with the Restorators at the end of the book.
Yeah. Which now brings us to chapter 20. And here we get a perspective change again. We're hanging out with Tersona, and she's talking to her underlord chief, Nedric, who became Yustin's replacement. And he's a straightforward kind of guy. Trasona's making a plan to get involved with producing a product that the domain becomes reliant on, so she become wealthy and powerful.
Yeah, and she has this idea because the Lord Chief payout didn't go to her for the first time, which we had seen talk of a couple chapters ago when Len and Norsen had showed up to Jerem and were complaining that Trasona kept winning. So now Trasona's like, fine, I don't need the payout. I'll find my own way to become wealthy and powerful.
Yeah, so she comes up with the idea that cattle is the way to go because people have been eating like protein-based bread and, you know, a lot of vegetative matter. And so our question for you, Nate, is that since this is a futuristic slash dystopian type of world, do you play around with the idea of genetically modified animals or food or anything of that nature within the construct of this world?
I definitely play around with the idea of genetically modified food. If there's animals, if anything, it would be just selective breeding. But I haven't touched up a lot on that. But I would say I just experiment with the idea of genetically modified people in general, because I do mention earlier in the book that there's a very rare breed of people called the long-lived that they can easily live past 100 years, and it's not like past 100, not like detrimental, like where you're just in a wheelchair the whole time, but like past 100 years. And so variation does come into play, and I do have something that will come into play in around the fifth novel. I won't release too much, but yeah, the idea is definitely there.
It's pretty cool.
Yeah, because we haven't really seen too many animals yet. I know that the Restrazers hunt, but I was like, oh, I wonder where they're getting all these cattle. Like, where are they going to come from? Especially if they're eating protein bread, which I'm assuming is just like so processed and different from what we would be eating. So I just thought it was kind of like a nice little world build where their food is different from ours.
Yeah.
So Trasona's going her own way for now. And we shift back to Captain Marcy at one of the new off-grid bases. And this is the scene where we really start to see the conflict with the Restrazers increase. So Captain Marcy, she is waiting for a shipment of supplies, but it's starting to get late. The boat has not arrived. And she's thinking in the back of her mind, like, all right, they probably aren't sailing at nighttime, but I really hope they get here. So I think she's trying to convince herself that everything is fine. But after a while of her trying to sleep or go to bed, they start to see distress flares come up from an area where the pontoon boat would be coming. So they decide to go check it out. And I like that immediately Marcy is like, this could be a trap. She didn't really fall for the idea that it's the pontoon boat just needing help. Like, she's aware. But she really doesn't want to lose these supplies. She knows how vital they are. It's not only food, but it's building supplies and stuff for their defenses, so they really need it. So she takes some of her soldiers to go look, and she leaves her second in command in charge. But when they get to the boat, it's abandoned, and she has all her soldiers go and check it out, but nobody is there. And they'd actually found that the flares were going off because they'd set up 5 guns to shoot off the flares, sort of at like little intervals. And this is when she starts to get the heebie-jeebies, so she immediately is like, all right, everybody off the boat, back to ours. Something's wrong. We need to get back to the off-grid.
And halfway there, they see explosions and fire coming from the off-grid. This was a distraction for the Restrazers to raid their base. So they're very good at these, like, skirmish tactics. A lot of surprise assaults that are quick and flashy and allow them to get the jump and surprise on their enemies.
Yeah, they're good at creating a distraction so your main soldiers are trying to take care of that when the real attack is coming from somewhere else.
Right, so the Restrazers have taken everyone prisoner inside, and their leader says, you're going to send a little message to that commander chief of yours. None of us here want anything to happen to these little off-gridders now, do we? And nothing has to happen. That all depends on you. You tell her that for every day you guys remain in our territory, I'm going to get rid of 10 of these off-gridders and tell her I'm going to make them choose which one I kill. So this is a very potent threat. And Marcy cuts the power to the shed as a tactic. But then she kind of waffles and decides to turn it back on.
Yeah, because they kill one off-gridder. Yeah. So there's nobody left in the compound at this point. Like, at least alive, except for in this shed. They've taken all the off-gridders hostage, and we actually learned that it's Engine himself in here. So the main threat came from Marcy. Unfortunately, when she decides to turn the power back on after that off-gridder hostage was killed, it won't come back on.
Yeah.
So even though she originally lied and was like, oh, the power is spotty, it actually is spotty, and they can't get it to come back on. They're fiddling with it. And unfortunately, in their attempts to turn the power back on, it starts a fire in the shed.
Yes.
So now they've trapped their own people in with the Restraisers, and the place is on fire. So
it's just getting worse and
things
worse.
Things are getting worse. It's horrible.
And the Restraisers come out. They're using the hostages as human shields. Marcy tries to have the Restraisers shot, but it's not really working. And then a huge explosion happens from the shed. So things are just going from bad to worse to terrible. Marcy wakes up. She's injured from the explosion, and Engine, of all people, standing over her. And dun, dun, dun. Classic villain, he says, well, it looks like we won't be leaving here without something to bargain with after all. And great little scene to end that chapter with such suspense. My question for you, Nate, is it seems like there are multiple groups of Restraisers.
We know there's different crews, but how many Restraisers are there?
Like, generally speaking, like, obviously we don't need, like, a figure count, but...
So, if you think of, like, Restraiser gang crews as, like, Scottish clans, like, they're just kind of united by this generic idea, but they're not, like, under one leadership. They're all very independent of each other, mm-hmm. and so each gang mm-hmm. crew is, like, an independent entity. And so, how many are there? Definitely not more than 50. So, I mean...
Oh, okay. Not more than 50 groups or 50 individuals?
More than 50 groups. Okay. And if you think of, like, a couple hundred in each group, it's only going to be, like, a couple of thousand. I mean, the world's not as heavily populated at this point in this world as it is now.
Okay, but it seems like the Domain has more people than the Restraisers, but aren't as brutal in their tactics.
No. That and, you know, so many people within the Domain aren't warriors.
Right, yeah, you've got a lot of miners and, like, food production people at this point, so it's because they're more sedentary, right?
Yeah.
So they need different job specialization, where the Restraisers are more of, like, a nomadic fighting culture. So most of their people that we've at least seen are all warrior-focused, and they have that brutality and ferocity that the Domain does not have.
Yeah.
But the Domain has a trained military, so we'll
see. Pros and cons.
We'll see which one prevails.
So it's like a... kind of like Revolutionary War stuff. Alrighty, so this brings us to chapter 21.
Yeah, so Shindo and Jerem are going over all these reports, and they're all about Restraiser attacks. So Marcy was not the only attack, not the only victim. It is clear that the Restraisers have attacked a bunch of bases, and the conclusion that they're drawing from all these reports is that the Restraisers will stoop to any tactic in fighting. So, again, we get an issue here where Shindo has one opinion and Jerem has another, and they're trying to figure out how to solve this and protect the off-gridders and protect their new expansions all at once. And it's a little bit tough here because Shindo is very altruistic, as we have seen, which I still think is a pretty unique trait in such a tough and dystopian world. Like, for someone who's had so many bad things happen to him, he's... just really channels that into making sure the bad things don't happen to anyone else. Like, he does not become bitter ever. And so he does not want to abandon the off-gridders or hurt them in any way, leave them open to attack. Whereas Jerem says they need to pull back from their posts because the Domain has grown too big too fast, which is one of those themes that we've been seeing. And because of this, the Domain doesn't have enough people to support itself. Like, they've spread themselves a little bit thin. They need to protect their supply lines and their food, but they also don't have enough people to maybe produce all that if they turn some of the producers into soldiers or protectors. So it's a little bit tight here. So in this moment, Shindo gets this idea. He has another episode with the Crown. He's getting, like, headaches and stuff from it. So again, I want him to take it off, but he won't take it off. I'm getting nervous for him.
Heavy is the crown.
Yeah. And because of this, he gets an idea to make a new vehicle.
Yeah, so I believe this vehicle is going to be a variation of the all-terrains we had already seen from the off-gridders. It's supposed to be fast and be able to travel on water and land. He realizes that they don't have the resources to make a fleet of these vehicles and agrees that they do need to scale back.
Yeah, because I think he says they would need at least 100 of these vehicles to be effective for his plan, and they just don't have the resources to build them in the time that they need. So we get a scene where we have to go more with Jerem's ideas than Shindo's ideas. And it's not that hers aren't in the interest of protecting people, but he really didn't want to have to abandon any of the posts. But they compromise because they're not going to abandon any of the off-gridders. They decide that they're going to have to move people and abandon some of the posts in order to save lives.
Yes.
Which I think is the best solution here. I think it makes the most sense. We see in the next couple of scenes that some of the off-gridders are not happy with it.
No.
So we're getting a little bit of turmoil within the new recruits to the domain. But the scene with Shindo and Jerem ends with this line that says, "It was always satisfying reaching a common understanding with her, even when they had voraciously disagreed before." And I think that just really sums up their leadership styles, is that, like, no matter how different their initial ideas are, they always come to a good conclusion.
And there's just so much respect and camaraderie between the two of them.
I wish we had leaders like that in our own world. Like, I like how well they could listen to each other, yeah.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, just the amount of, like, listening and compromise is amazing. And then even if they lose out on some of their own ideas, or, like, in the compromise say, like, oh, I'll agree to do this thing that you want to do, then they, like, wholeheartedly do it.
Yeah,
it's they not fall like, through. Oh, I didn't get my way. I'm going to say I'm going to do one thing and turn around and do what I want to do anyway. Like, they actually really care about the domain and they care about their people. And just refreshing to see, because obviously we see a lot of the times, like, power corrupts, and I think they're not being corrupted because they're balancing each other so well, keeping each other focused on solving problems.
Yes. Well said. We then get a perspective change, and we see that Kellen learns that the military is falling back from the off-grids. He asks for some soldiers to be left behind because they're not being abandoned, and a character, Captain Geld, tells Kellen that they'll be retreating in a few steps so the off-gridders will carry on working and making food while the military packs up the mining equipment.
I think specifically, too, he says keep working on building your defenses.
Yes.
So, yeah, this is the Shindo and Jerem compromise plan in action. But like I said, the off-gridders aren't happy with... Some of them aren't happy with this.
Right. So Geld says that they'll relocate everyone to the base and that there might not be enough room, and that Kellen's people will just have to go back to this undefended off-grid. So they're being put in a precarious position, especially with this continued threat from the Rust Raisers.
I feel like I would really try to just make sure that... I know that it's tough to, like, squeeze people into a place mm-hmm. if you don't have enough resources, but that seems like it would be better than just letting them tough it out on their own against the Rust Raisers.
Yeah, they're kind of getting sent... Not necessarily sent to their death, but they're going to be in a very vulnerable position.
Yeah, I don't like that they have to get shuffled around so much. And we start to see this, like, Mattis, especially Kellen's nephew, is one of the people who doesn't like this idea. Kellen has a little meeting with everyone in his off-grid, and he explains, like, they're going to have to move. And, like I said, Mattis is not pleased with this. He's like, you know, if the domain can't protect us against the Rust Raisers, why don't we just protect ourselves? Which is the position they were in the first place.
So yeah.
He's being really stubborn, and I think this is going to spell bad news for him. But Kellen says it's temporary, and then they'll return. So we're starting to see Kellen's grown a little bit more flexible as a leader, too. But again, Mattis is just refusing to leave and move another time. He doesn't want to have to do it. And then Kellen's wife, Celia, agrees, too. She's like, if the domain can't defend themselves from the Rust Raisers now, how are they supposed to protect us? So
yeah.
They're starting to doubt Jerem's leadership and Shindo's power as leaders. So I don't know. It's a little bit tough because I feel like they wanted to be part of the domain so badly, and now they're already like, oh, no.
Yeah. they're kind of like, screw the domain. Like,
yeah, so it's a little bit tough to be the off-gridders. They're getting shuffled around a lot, but I think having seen how brutal Rust Raiders are, they would be smart to try to take the domain's protection and, you know, go along with what they want them to do right now. And then, again, just leaders have to constantly compromise. So Kellen says, all right, fine, we'll leave, but let's use our last few days here to really bolster the defenses so that if we do have to come back and we don't get military support from the domain, our defenses will be good. So at least he's thinking ahead and coming up with solutions that give people purpose in the meantime. And it seems to satisfy everyone for now.
Yeah.
But people are just getting grumpy with having to move so much. They don't like constantly being like wedged in against all these other people and like condensed down into these little bases. So
hard times in the domain.
Yeah, again, just like the repeating theme of like they've grown a little too big too fast and dissenting voices are starting to appear.
Yeah.
Speaking of which, we're back to Tersona and she's just kind of going her own direction all of a sudden.
Yeah, she's continuing her conquest for cattle and they found a pretty good valley to start their ranch and she's testing the quality of the water. She's convinced the off-gridders to return to the valley and work for her if it's good for her cattle. And Nedric asked Tersona if Lan and Norsen will have the same idea as them to start something so they no longer need to rely on the Lord Chief's payout. And Tersona says that they have small minds, and this is playing back to that theme that we were mentioning back in the archives of that complacency and that arrogance can be a leader's downfall. So
I think it's a little bit of foreshadowing here that Tersona might be facing her downfall pretty soon.
Mm.
I'm not sure how it's going to go because in this next scene, she makes a deal with a group of Rust Raisers. And I think this deal is going to end up going sour, or Jerem will say, you can't be part of my domain anymore if you're dealing with the Rust Raisers. Like, something's going to come from this.
That's, yeah, there's going to be consequence.
Yeah, there's no way she can just go out on her own like this. Because specifically what she does, she meets this group of Rust Raisers and they say they want to trade. Their leader is this guy named Mastower. And at first, Tersona thinks they're lying until Mastower says Engine screwed over all the Rust Raisers by breaking his deal with the domain. So we're starting to see conflict within the Rust Raisers as well. I think the domain had seen the Rust Raisers as one unified group up until this point, but they're definitely fractured. And Tersona realizes that they're really hungry and they're actually trying to trade for food. So she exploits this disadvantage that they have by saying, all right, well, I will give you food and shelter if you act as guards for me for my new ranch, my new cattle ranch. And I just feel like that's either going to turn Engine against them or it's going to turn Jerem against Tersona because there's too many deals with like the enemy, quote unquote, and I think it's going to be dangerous. So, I don't know. I'm not sure how this is going to play out in a way that's easy for everyone here.
Yeah, things are getting very complicated. And so our question for you, Nate, is that Tersona's going off the rails and acting in her own self-interest. Can you talk about developing like subplots that cause internal conflict between the domain and leaders? Was that something you knew you needed? Or did you just look at it realistically and say, hey, we have all these different factions of leaders, someone's bound to go off the rails eventually?
So a lot of it was basically I just stand by my tenet of the world's complicated and different people want different things. And so I talk about when you're in power, you can't just do whatever you want. You got to kind of like keep certain people happy, and also understanding when that's shifting and changing. Now a lot of it's not very direct, it's indirect. And so I wanted to make a commentary on somebody sort of gaining an indirect means of power. I think a very relevant example nowadays is like the tech industry, how they're not elected by anyone, but just because like we're so heavily dependent upon it and there's only so many sites for social media or buying stuff online, they end up in effect having a great degree of say and power over our everyday world. So I wanted to have this idea of somebody sort of establishing something that could easily interweave and slice itself with society in such a way that you wouldn't really notice it was a problem until it's too late. And by then you'd realize that it's just too complicated to get rid of the infection, so to speak.
No, it makes sense. You know, we have a lot of industries that I think could definitely function as that role. Like different choices would have fit really well in here. So like she chose food, but I think depending on the type of world, like you said, tech is really huge in our world. Like transportation could be really important for different societies at different times. You know, like different types of industries, you can make yourself really powerful and influential if you provide especially something to the government. Or like here, it was almost like perfectly tied in. I don't know if Tersona said it or somebody else, but they were like, hey, an army marches on its stomach and the domain is really growing in militaristic power. So providing that food makes Tersona super valuable, not only to the regular people, but to the government as well. So yeah, I like how she's trying to like insert herself in a bit of an insidious way where you wouldn't notice it. And then it's like, oh, she has a monopoly on this and it's going to be really hard to break it because it actually is like benefiting everyone. But at the same time, that comes with a bit of a price too.
Yeah, for sure.
All right. Last chapter.
Ooh, I can't believe it.
Well, not last chapter of the book, just last chapter of the episode.
And man, things get heavy.
This is an intense chapter. So it starts with the Rustraisers leaving a piece of broken concrete outside one of the bases as a message. And Jerem asks Torque as her prisoner to interpret this piece of concrete. And he says, first off, that engine wants to meet, and it'll be at the location of the broken dam. And then secondly, he has something to give her back, but it's going to cost her. So immediately she thinks, all right, I'm going to exchange Torque for Marcy. We'll do a prisoner exchange. I think we were all kind of on the same page when they were saying that. I was like, oh, obviously, like, we're going to get Marcy back. And they travel to the dam. She's really cautious going there. She sends scouts ahead. They travel in single file. She makes Torque walk in front in case there's any traps. So she's being really proactive about this. And they get all the way there. They climb up this. There's like a pile of trash in the broken dam. They climb up it and exchange the prisoners. And it seems fine.
And that's what was too suspicious.
False sense of security here. They're like, all right. I think she did say there would be nothing preventing them from attacking on the retreat. But they go for a good while before anything happens. So I was like, wow, are they really going to be able to get out of this scenario and get out of Rustraiser territory unscathed? But no. Definitely not.
No.
Before the attack happens, though, they're all traveling on pontoon boats. And Marcy reveals how she and these other prisoners retreated. They were moved around a lot from place to place. They were forced to dance naked in front of the Rustraisers. They had been sexually assaulted by them. So the Rustraisers really are similar to the culture that was around under Vibran. So,
yeah, just barbaric tendencies.
Yeah, definitely not great. I think it's very clear that like they are the bad guys in this world. And it really rallies us around the fact that like we need to defeat them by the end of the book. They're enemy number one. And Jerem obviously can empathize with Marcy here because she was part of Vibran's harem. So we're kind of seeing this like powerful bond between two women leaders and saying like, all right, we really gotta take care of this issue. But as they're having this little debrief, all of a sudden the boats get stuck on something. And this is where things start to go really bad.
Oh yeah. A diver reveals it's debris from the four laps with spikes going in both directions so they can't move. And they're attacked on all sides by guns and cannons, and some of the boats begin to sink. There's like wolves coming out to the boats with explosives. Like things are just off the rails. My question for you, Nate, is how did you come up with an idea like this as far as with the diversity of a naval-based conflict within the story?
To me, I've really established these Rustraisers as there's really no low they won't stoop to. There's no extreme they won't go to. And so I think I've said it before, like no pain for the writer, no pain for the reader. And so like I like animals, and so like it's very painful for me when like they're being thrown at and used in a conflict situation like this. Like I saw This is a bit of an aside, but it's like in, I don't know if you guys saw Napoleon, but in the beginning, he's charging at a fortress with his horse, and his horse gets shot in the chest with a cannon. And it always gets him when the animals get it, because they're just kind of like, to me, they just might as well be innocent bystanders. There's that. And in terms of the spikes, it's, I always like having this, like, they're always one step ahead of you. They always pull a fast one on you. So I said, like, well, how do you trap the boats? Well, if you have, like, spikes that kind of go in both directions inward, and then one folds down like this, so the boat can get over it, but it gets, like, trapped going back, that would be quite harrowing. So that is what's going through my head as I come up with these scenarios.
Well, the animals definitely got me. I think one of the other authors we talked to said a tactic that you can use for writing a villain that you can sympathize with is you always show them being kind to an animal, even in their mean to people. Like, if you want to make them a more sympathetic villain. So these restorators have no sympathy from me. If they are using animals in this way, I hate them. They're evil. Leave the dogs and the wolves alone. They didn't do anything. So, yeah, I think that was a really good way to show how evil and how much they don't really care about the consequences of their actions.
Yes, and our characters are receiving the repercussions of these actions. The boats are sinking. Marcy's trapped, and Jerem's trying to pry her free, but she can't. There's too many crates, and it's too compact of a space. And, you know, we have this sincere moment where Marcy's just like, go save yourself. It is what it is. And Jerem's like, no, we'll get through this together. You know, we just got her back. And unfortunately, Marcy drowns and Jerem is forced to flee the conflict.
And that guilt of that last line of like, don't blame yourself, really carries through to Jerem. She spends the rest of this chapter full of internal conflict. She's got like post-traumatic stress from this, as well as physical injuries. So she's hurt on both the mental end and the emotional end and the physical end. And because of this, this is really affecting her leadership. She said she's having trouble focusing and making some decisions. And you slipped in this line that said, perhaps knowledge alone wasn't enough to make one an effective leader.
Great quote.
I really liked that because I think it shows that Jerem's starting to feel a little bit of self-doubt for herself because something tragic did happen around her. And I think that's one thing that's really tough about being a leader is that like you do have to keep your head high even when bad things happen and keep leading. And I think Jerem is a good leader. She does have the knowledge, but she actually like puts it into play. But she's starting to doubt herself because this is the first time something really bad has happened to somebody close to her. And so she actually goes to Shindo for comfort, and he's working on the new machine, but he stops to talk to Jerem. And obviously she is distraught because of Marcy. And I think she's saying like, well, Marcy was one of my first like lieutenants. She graduated from my female military program. She represented a lot of hope and potential for the future. So Jerem's kind of like couching her grief in this idea of what Marcy represented as well, instead of maybe initially admitting that she's really sad about the situation, which she does come to do, but it's a little bit, it's like kind of twofold what she's sad about. And then just down on herself because she feels responsible and feels guilty.
Yeah. Shindo does a great job. He comforts her and he says, Restorators are a tough enemy, but to defeat them, they'll have to find someone who's also not afraid of death. And so
Is this a bit of foreshadowing? Who do you think it would be?
I think it's more of like, we'll have to find someone. That person was you all along kind of thing.
Ooh.
But what I just wanted to highlight was, again, like so much growth out of Shindo, being able to form relationships where he's close enough to give people comfort and assurance where, again, since the beginning of the book of him,
he was so isolated at the beginning. He didn't really have anyone he could talk to in this way. And the way that he really supports Jerem and gives her the kind of advice that she needs in this situation is really nice. And the way that he really ends up supporting her helps Jerem kind of face the future. And she asks Shindo why he's just never given up. Like, all this bad stuff has happened. He had to work under Vibran for so long, but, like, he always keeps coming up with solutions and having ideas. And he says, because we are giving people the lives we were never allowed to have. To me, that is a selfless act that speaks for itself and should ask for nothing in return. Why should it? To me, it's the greatest thing one can hope to accomplish, to see the calm that will come one day because of us.
Awesome, 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 cool. I love that.
I just really like that he doesn't have this idea of, and I think we see it a lot right now because, like, people online love to pit generations against one another, and people are always like, oh, these young kids, they're a spoiled generation that comes after us or whatever. Whereas Shindo's saying, like, hey, if I have to suffer to make the world better for the next generation and, like, they can enjoy the, like, calm that comes from my efforts and, like, a better world, I think that's really valuable and really honorable, and I don't need anything in return. Like, that's what we should all be striving for, is improvement and making things better for other people. But, you know, it's hard to see that sometimes in real life, but Shido does a really good job of not losing hope.
Right, especially now that Jerem has lost some of her faith in the abstract, and it's going to be really interesting to see what develops with our final episode, if Jerem can restore her faith in the abstract and herself, or if this will lead to her downfall as a character.
Yeah, but you've planted kind of a lot of things across the board. Like, you've got personal doubt, you got conflict between some characters in the way that, like, Tersona's splintering off from the others. You've got people questioning Jerem's leadership abilities. We've got the death of some of our domain leaders, and then the off-gridders are getting a little bit riled up too. So there's, like, not only the conflict with the Rust Rangers, but all these other factors coming into play right at the end of the book. And they're all going to be really important, I think, in the final conflict.
Yeah. So I'm really interested to see if our characters can hold it together enough to overcome this enemy and, quote unquote, save the day. So,
I'm interested to see how it plays out, because all the battles so far have been unique and different. And, like, with this this fight on the pontoon boats, I think was really exciting to read. It obviously was really upsetting to see our characters suffer and to see the animals. The animals suffer. I think it made for really good, like, conflict and plot in a book. You know, you don't want your characters to walk in and to a situation you think, well, oh, they can't die because they're the main characters.
Right.
Like, the stakes have been high throughout the book, and I think that's been something that's going to really come into play for the last little bit.
For sure.
So I have some predictions that I think some of our off-gridder friends might end up being some of the casualties. Like, I think maybe someone in Kellen's group might die.
I imagine so. We've built a lot around them, and although they are important, I can imagine losing them will again demonstrate the lethality of the Rust Rangers and how the domain is failing to keep all its denizens safe. I can see how Tersona could potentially make it through all this just to split into her own separate faction towards the end.
Ooh.
I imagine
maybe Shindo, Tersona can persuade some of the Rust Rangers to fight against Engine, though.
Because right, it could be like a civil war.
Yeah. Oh, there's a lot of potential for the end.
I imagine Shindo will make it through.
He has to. He's a main character of the eight.
You never know. There could be perspective change.
But will he have the crown the whole time?
Yeah.
Or will the crown have to come off?
Right. Instead of the gloves coming off, the crown is coming off.
Not like the physical crown.
Okay.
not like will he be leader.
Gotcha.
I meant, like, is there going to be consequences from him wearing that?
Right. Oh, there definitely will be. Also, Jerem, I am not wholeheartedly convinced she will make it. You know? She's a great character. I love what she's done for the domain, but
it would be interesting if Shindo, like, has to step up.
Right, like her sacrifice and what that could mean, if that's a possibility. So,
I know you can't say anything on our predictions because that will ruin it, but I hope you're enjoying our guesses. Well, we'll find out next week anyway, because we'll see who wins and who survives and everything. But it's been very fun watching all the characters grow. I've been having a good time seeing all the different landscapes that they've been going through. So I think the final battle, too, depending on where it takes place, could be really exciting.
Oh, definitely. And what technologies will come into play.
Yeah. So that's my two cents. Ooh, before we wrap up, since your book is actually out and available now, do you just want to tell people how they can get a copy?
Yes, you guys can go into Amazon, you can go into Apple Books, Google Books, Kobo. I think you can even order a physical copy from Indigo Chapters. You can get it in electronic format, paperback, and hardcover. And if you guys have been following along, you're in for some good stuff. So yeah, please buy a copy and rate it and leave a review. Even if it's just, I like it. It still helps me out, guys. Please, not today. Thank you.
That's very important. Yeah, if you put a lot of time into a project, obviously. That's good stuff. Did it come out no, it came out a couple days ago.
Tuesday.
It came Perfect. Out Tuesday. Perfect. And then I think you said this episode will be on your is this one coming out on your birthday?
Is it coming out on Thursday? Yeah, the 15th is my
Happy birthday.
Thank you.
Wow. Fun, exciting things for you. And I think we'll see you. Hopefully we'll be able to drop into the party tonight for a little bit.
Yes.
Cool. Thank you.
Thanks, listeners. If you're looking for more, check us out at fantasticbookspod.com, where we have book reviews, reading list suggestions, merch, and you can even send us a message.
Or find us on Facebook and Instagram at Fantastic Books Pod.
And if you like what you've been hearing, don't forget to leave us a review.
Thanks.
Golden Rise Media.